Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Ghouls in the House. I'm Arnold T. Blumberg.
And I'm Natalie Litovsky.
And happy holidays and season's greetings. This is our annual holiday episode. And for this year, we've decided to do a very video nasty Christmas. And I found two movies for us to watch, both of which were on the list of things I wanted to get to at some point.
It's a long list that we have.
Yeah, one of which I'm very glad we finally got around to, one of which I very much regret. But I'm glad to have seen it so that I know I never have to look at it again.
Yeah, I would agree.
And I bought that one. Damn it.
Well, now it's archived in case we gotta explain to someone sometime why it's awful.
Anyway. Over the years doing the podcasts, I also started doing a thing where I really wanted a label when we did Video Nasties and keep an eye on it. I've been trying also and just personally to like see more of them. I'm fascinated by that, just as a side note. Any of us that grew up at a certain time, without getting too deep into it, there are whole documentaries on this kind of thing, obviously.
Which we've seen.
Which we've seen and own some of. It's just... You create these ridiculous things, whether it's the Satanic Panic of the 80s, which was also went hand in hand with some of this.
For sure.
And any of these kind of things. You just create a desire to see the stuff. And I've been keeping a list for a few years now as I've been trying to make a more concerted effort to watch a lot of things I've never seen, like Paul Naschy werewolf movies, which I've been enjoying watching a lot of. Most of them are awful.
Most of them, it sounds like, are the same movie, but just with movie. Like the Mad Lib is a different order than it was
sometimes
the first time.
He just remakes the same movie over and over again.
He's having fun.
And trying to tick off some more video nasties. There are some I'm not sure I'm interested in ever watching because some of the video nasties are less horror movies and more fall into the realm of like just the pure cruelty, Last House on the Left kind of stuff. I've seen enough of that. Also, there's an entire subcategory in the video nasties of Nazi exploitation movies. Not sure I care to bother with that. But on slashers and things like that, I've been trying to tick them off. And pretty much 99% of the time, the thing I've most discovered is another aspect of these kind of panics is you create a panic and mostly it's about nothing. Not only are they not all that offensive or immoral or off, certainly by today's standards they're tame when you finally get around to
and them. All of that is so subjective too, about like what's immoral or what have you. And completely agree. I feel like almost every single time we watch a video nasty, I'm like, why did someone put this on the list? And sometimes I think it's because they didn't get it. And they're like, I don't understand why people are watching this, so I'm putting it on the list.
And then we watched one of the movies for this episode.
Yeah.
And then I thought, that's why you make a list. Finally, I understand. So this time around, we are watching two, ostensibly they're both considered slashers, but they're extremely different films.
Very.
One is sort of very much in the mold of a standard copycat 80s slasher, now known most often as The Dorm That Dripped Blood from 1982, although also known alternately over the years as Pranks, and that was the name I think it was under when it was put on the Section 2 part of the Video Nasty list. So quick version of this. It's a little more complicated, but basically there are three sections of the Video Nasty list when they put it together. Section 1 were prosecuted under obscenities charges. Section 2, if I remember right, were never prosecuted, but were forfeited. If they were forfeited and they admitted that it was obscenity, they could, like, they seized them without prosecuting.
Basically
something
got
like
pulled
that
from circulation, but no legal case.
And some Section 1 titles that weren't successfully prosecuted then got put on the Section 2 list. Then there was Section 3, which were ones that were classified to be seized under a lesser charge, and I think also would be destroyed if they were forfeited or something. So there are like three tiers of the Video Nasty list. Dorm That Dripped Blood, Pranks, Death Dorm, from 1982, was a Section 2 Video Nasty. The other one we're doing this time is the now very often well-regarded slasher.
There's big air quotes on slasher.
Yeah, Christmas Evil from 1980, which was in the third section. It was a Section 3 video nasty. So both of these were on the infamous list. One of them definitely deserves to be on it. And let's start with that one, the dorm that drip blood.
Shall we?
Or pranks.
Or a death dorm.
You think we need to go up there?
Need to? We don't need to do anything.
Which, yeah, well, the version we saw was the Synapse restoration of it.
They kind of covered all the titles in a way.
Yeah, which covers all the, includes all the gore that was apparently cut out too, which is one of the few, if you're into that sort of thing, bright spots of the movie. Because, yes, the killing in this movie, as far as slashers go, it's inventive, it's varying, and there's some pretty good effect shots in some of it. It is also Daphne Zuniga's film debut, which is listed everywhere you find this, and she's in it for all of 5 minutes before she has her head run over by a car.
Off screen.
Did I mention, spoiler alert, if you've been listening to this show, you certainly know that we start with full spoilers.
I don't even care if I spoil this one. I don't want you to watch it.
No, we absolutely, we not only don't recommend it, we are vehemently against this movie. It's one of the most reprehensible, objectionable movies I can remember seeing in a long time.
The movie was so bad that when the credits came up, I actually yelled boo at my own television in my own living room very loudly and repeatedly.
Short version is there's practically next to no Christmas iconography, a couple quick shots of lights.
And it always is billed as something like it's over the Christmas break, it's a Christmas movie. Yeah. You see Christmas lights twice in the whole film.
But the basic premise being that a group of kids at college have agreed to stay on campus over the Christmas break to help clear out a condemned dorm before it's going to be sold off. All the stuff's going to be sold off, which already immediately made no sense to me, because it's like you could ask kids to do this, I assume, for money, for credit, for something. But surely, given the liability issues of sticking them in a condemned building, where's the rest of the staff? But no, it's just them.
Well, it kind of makes sense a little bit, because they repeatedly refer to it as a student co-op. So that means that it was probably student organized, student run, like the front office, back office stuff was handled by students who were paid like a stipend to do it. So I guess the students kind of are the staff, because like our main character, our main girl is Joanne, is the one who kind of runs the front office for the dorm.
The music's good, although there's
weird, but good.
There's an exceptional reliance on xylophone. We're really impressed with the energy and resilience of the xylophone player.
Imagine the SNL sketch for Blue Oyster Cult where Will Ferrell is just going to town on that cowbell. That is the xylophone artist in this film.
And the music is done by Christopher Young, who went on to huge, bigger and better movies over the years, including Marvel level stuff and all kind of stuff. So he did fine. In fact, most of the team that made this went on to make a movie we became familiar with through Riff Tracks, The Power.
Which also has good effects.
Yeah, because Matthew Mungall worked on the makeup effects. He's also moved on to be like a big name in huge A-level filmmaking. And
now that I think about it, The Power has a lot of similarities in mood to this movie as well. Like, obviously there's like demonic possession involved, but actually it kind of ends kind of the same way a little bit.
So we got the kids in the dorm, and then everybody starts getting picked off. And one of the things that we were immediately confused by was that this slasher, it definitely is a slasher. We'll talk about how Christmas Evil doesn't quite deserve to be called a slasher.
Though this one's a few and far between slasher.
It has killing scenes, they're impressive for this level of filmmaking, but there are huge gaps. It's boring in huge stretches. It's one of the darkest movies we've watched in a long time, and I mean that in every way.
Yeah.
But particularly in this context, I mean, you can't see the movie. It is so dark. There's even a scene late in the movie where one of the characters says, "It's dark in here, isn't it?" And we're like, yes, it is.
I first noticed it actually pretty early in the film where Daphne Zuniga's character, who I can't even remember her name. I think they say it like once because, you know, she's going to be dead soon. So Debbie? What does it matter? Sure. Debbie. Why not?
Let's just say Debbie.
She goes,
I think it is.
She goes down to a storeroom to get like an inventory list for her. And like she opens the door and walks into the storeroom. And the light is very far away from the door and it's nighttime. So they just do it in real time. Where they just are filming the dark room while she winds her way through to wherever the pull switch is on the light bulb. Mm-hmm. And like a competent filmmaker would show her walking in the room and then they'd have her pull the light switch and they'd edit out the walking to the light switch in between. But instead you get like 10 seconds of staring at a dark storage room.
Or you do like the Dean Cundey or other route, which is design your set so the shafts of light come in where it's relevant to keep your characters lit.
Right, you fake like, the light.
You don't need reality. You just need a structure.
You need a pretend window where the moon is shining in.
Right, exactly. And these people didn't know that.
They had a camera and an empty dorm over winter break.
Yeah. As I was saying, we didn't know what was going on. And in so many of these kind of slashers, there are certain patterns. And while there are many more than just two, the two things that I kept thinking was, well, you have two approaches that I couldn't decide which one they were doing. And like I said, there are more than two, but...
Yeah.
There, one is you do the standard prom night, Halloween... multiple versions of this, in which your movie starts with Friday the 13th, starts with something that sets up why this person is likely to be a killer later or some trauma event, and then you flash forward to the present and it's like, oh, I see, that created a killer one way or another.
With the like college set ones, it's often something that happened earlier in college life.
Right.
You think of like Terror Train.
Right.
You know, where it just happened a couple years prior exactly. at the school. And then things not set on college campuses, it's usually something in childhood that yes. then refers forward.
Which we'll talk about.
Just and cut to Randy screaming, there's a formula.
Yes.
See, the police are always off track with this shit. If they watch prom night, they'd save time. There's a formula to it. A very simple formula. Everybody's a suspect.
And then, and we'll talk about that with the next one. But another way to go is, which doesn't happen that often, and I would argue has to be done a certain way in order to make it successful, is the randomness of a cold, uncaring universe. You never find out what's going on. It's just, this is bad things happen.
Valid.
Black Christmas arguably is a good example of that because despite all the information you can sort of kind of glean about the backstory, which people have written just tons about, it was made very clear by Bob Clark and the rest of the people involved in making the movie that none of the things Billy is saying on the phone was strictly ever thought of in terms of a coherent story. So
in subsequent remakes, they definitely went yes. with the flashback, we're giving you a story. Like BS that you don't need.
So we couldn't figure out what's going on. And we thought, is this going to be one of these ones where there's no answer? And it turns out, no, there is an answer. There's just a terrible, lame one. Because it isn't until the final act, literally the last, 10 minutes, that we find out that it's just because one of the guys in this group is into the main girl, wanted to get rid of everybody around her, although that strangely involves a handyman and the parents of one of the other girls who clearly can't pose a threat in any way romantically.
And not her actual boyfriend, who just gets to leave on a ski trip with his bros in the first scene of the film.
Right.
And just drive off in a Jeep with snow tires that his bro is super excited that he put on the car.
And you pointed out something the movie didn't even do, which would have made sense, which was us finding out later, perhaps, that he would have, like, damaged the car, or somehow they never made it, or she'd get a phone call, where are they? They never showed up, and they don't do that. So he didn't even try to kill the real boyfriend.
I guess he was going to do it when he got back? Like, it doesn't make any sense.
There is a scene late in the movie where he kills one of the girls in a kitchen, using one of Groen's many fine professional kitchen products.
It's front and center, and lit with the flashing green and red bulbs of a distant string of Christmas lights.
Groen's like, we are going to be so visible in this movie. It's awesome. But there's the scene where he dumps her in that I feel, that was like maybe, that itself was maybe like 10 minutes before the big reveal.
Mm-hmm.
Big reveal. And when he dumped her in, I was like, is it just me, or is it clearly obvious it's only the one guy doing this? Because you could clearly see it was the same actor. They tried to like hide his head, but I'm thinking, well, look, at that point in the movie, we really only have like two or three options.
Everybody else is dead.
And it was like, nah, it just looks like him. That's who it's got to be. And then they reveal it's him. And I was like, yeah, of course, because that's who it is. So, I mean, like, there was not much of a, there wasn't a backstory. You also don't, you don't get a backstory. Like, why is he crazy? Like, why is he this worked up about it? We don't even get any tidbits along the way for why he'd be interested in her. He doesn't show any. The one thing we do get is once during the movie, he pulls a prank.
Once.
Which may have been where the title pranks came from, except there's one prank and never any more pranks.
And it's right at the beginning, like day one, they're cooking breakfast and he puts a fake spider on the grill top on an egg and they go, ah.
Solid gold prank
and
work.
That's literally the only prank. So it's prank singular
yeah.
at best. Unless all the killing is considered pranks, but I don't think that's really.
I think that may be what they were thinking, but like, it doesn't come across.
It doesn't. Work. And then I think maybe one of the things that was so frustrating for me watching, I won't say the thing that bothered me the most because that was the ending, which we'll get to.
Okay.
But one of the things that frustrated me throughout is they spent so much time just sprinkling red herrings all over the place.
Yes.
Like they were desperately trying to get you to think it could be any of these guys. And that includes like weirdo loner who's kind of maybe an upperclassman because he lives in on-campus housing but doesn't act like a student and never talks and he's not supposed to be there but he's on campus and it keeps popping up in front of dumpsters and windows.
And goes through the trash.
Goes through the trash. You've also got creepy towny guy who likes to go through the dumpsters on
campus.
Goes
through the trash.
And he came and bought a bunch of the desks and tried to pick up our main girl, Joanne, and got too close to her and even called her in the middle of the night from home.
While his girlfriend is sleeping with him.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. You've then got our secondary girl, who's, I can't even remember anybody's name.
It doesn't matter.
They're all unimportant and dead. But you've got your secondary girl, who's the one who gets drowned in the grown steamer in the commercial kitchen. She gets a letter from an old boyfriend from back home because her mom like gave him her address because she thinks they're still dating. And she's like, yeah, it's weird. You know, we're not actually together, thinking like, oh, could it be her ex who's come
right.
to town? And then you think, oh, the handyman keeps showing up like whenever something goes wrong. Is it him?
Mm-hmm.
And like Brian, the other guy there, he's like kind of sweet on Joanne. Like maybe. No, it's not. It's not
it's not any
of them. And then the guy who it is doesn't make any sense because he's just a general run of the mill jerk. But like he's not creepy outside of like regular man creepy.
Also, I have no desire to go through this movie ever again, but no. I also got this weird feeling throughout that the movie is one of those movies that didn't 100% play fair with where he should be at every point in time
yeah.
for him to commit the crimes.
Agreed.
I don't think it was correct sometimes, but I don't care, so I'm not gonna look at it again. But and also, there's so much about, oh, we got to go look here. We got to go do this. We got to go. And at one point I said to you, and I wrote it down because you were laughing. This is true. I said, there's a lot going on in this movie for there to be nothing happening.
Yeah.
And it's 88 minutes. This is the restored version, by the way, too. Adding back in gore and other bits and pieces that have been cut out, I think down to 82. And at 88 minutes, this is too long.
At 88 minutes, it feels the length of a Marvel movie.
Yeah.
It's interminable. It never ends.
We also have the cop, by the way, when you mentioned other people. We
yeah.
also have the cop show up, ask them a couple general questions, do nothing to help them, and then leave after telling them, just keep doing what you're doing and we'll check later. The cops are worthless, and that's typical.
Right up until the end.
Right up until the end. The ending of this movie reminded us of a movie we recently watched, Fatal Games. We also felt there were some similarities to things like Graduation Day.
Mm-hmm.
Final shot of this movie reminded me of a shot from Return of the Living Dead. That's not anything thematic. I just the smokestack thing, just like, oh, Return of the Living Dead. I think most of all what struck me is, okay, so the ending.
Yeah.
So basically, it turns out to be this one guy. He's interested in the main girl, Joanne. He's killing everybody for reasons that are... Oh, that's another thing. He kind of seems to make it sound like he's like, he wants a partner to keep killing.
Yeah, he like basically and... orchestrates it so that the like creepy guy on campus is like shows up and he's like holding a knife and Joanne freaks out and is like attacking him. And he doesn't know how to use his words, so he's trying to tell her that she, like, she has to come with him, but he could just be saying, hey, Craig's the killer. But he doesn't just say it, so she's still afraid of him, and they're running in circles, and he basically orchestrates it so that he tussles with, like, he being Craig, the bad guy, tussles with the creepy guy, so that Joanne has to grab one of the murder weapons, which is a bat with nails in it, a la Negan, and hit him over the head with it. And that's when he really gets excited and reveals that it was him, because now she's killed too, and now they can share in this together.
But he drops it immediately as soon as she shows any inkling of not wanting to be with him on this, and then decides he's going to kill her too. And in what's like, I thought right to the end, we're getting the cops are coming, the other idiot that wanted her, the townie guy, is showing up. And then there was a movie I also saw recently whose name I can't remember. It was one of the many slashers I've been like filling in on Tubi. I can't remember the name of it now. But there's another one I just saw where they shoot the wrong guy at the end and the killer gets away. And I think it was a girl who was the killer in that one. I cannot remember the name. We didn't do it on the podcast. I guess it doesn't really matter. It just bothers me. But when we got to the end bit, I thought to myself, is this going to end like that other one where the wrong guy is shot and the wrong guy is shot? Craig, our killer, is fine. And then the cops say, we're going to go get some medical help and stuff. So you stay here. And he's like, no problem. And while they're doing that, he just goes over to where he already had the knocked out Joanne because he was mad at her for not wanting to be his killer partner. And he just carries her over to an incinerator and dumps her in. And then
all
the
while
cops,
telling her while she's knocked out and can't hear him, it's better this way. You won't feel anything.
And then the cops outside are standing right next to the smokestack. And it's like, should it smell like that? Eh. And I was genuinely stunned at the level of sheer hatefulness of that ending.
Yeah.
Now, of course, a lot right now we talk about a better and more open, and I hope continuing open, awareness of toxic masculinity. And boy, this movie have tons of it, including things like that guy who calls to try to set up a date with her.
At 2 a.m.
At 2 a.m. in the morning while he's still in bed with the other girl who wants him back in bed and really tries, but isn't interesting to him anymore.
And she offers the only nudity in the film.
And then her so-called stalker, who we don't even know is interested until the end when he says he is, but obviously he's murdering people for her. And the guy at the beginning, who also... Here's where the Black Christmas stuff started to come in for me, too.
Because
we all know Black Christmas, now we're talking about a quality film. And one of the real things about it, we just watched it again on the date of its 50th anniversary, is how much that movie is about the women having no agency, seeking agency. She wants to get an abortion. Her boyfriend is like telling her, you're not doing that. And
there's a lot of gaslighting from everyone.
Yeah, the insane amount of entitlement he's got. Like, well, this is not what I want. As if the fact that he wants something somehow overrules her desires or interests as a fellow human. And there's a part at the beginning of this movie where we meet our Joanne character, our final girl, who is not, because she gets killed by another toxic guy.
She is the final girl to get killed.
Yeah. Where she's talking with her boyfriend at the party before they all leave. And she says something like, I don't know what I want. And he says, well, I know what I want. As if that should end the conversation.
And what he wants is to get an apartment and have them move in together. And she's not so sure that that's the direction she wants to go.
So once again, she's dealing with a man by the end of this movie who wants something she doesn't want. And his solution is, well, you're just going to have to be dead then. And he does it. And he succeeds and arguably gets away with everything. And the cops are useless. That part we could predict a mile away.
And in a sense, like, her boyfriend gets out scot-free, just like Paul does in Halloween.
Yes.
Where, like, Annie's going to go meet with Paul, but she gets killed before she can go meet up with him. And he's fine. He, like, never gets anywhere near the madness.
And at the end of Black Christmas, it is equally as tragic and awful in yes. that Olivia Hussey's character, I can't remember her name, Olivia Hussey dies, because if you read the ending correctly, which took me a few times to realize in reading about it, is that he always makes the phone calls after he kills somebody, leave her alone in the room, and then as the movie ends with the credits, we hear the phone ringing, and the implication is he just killed her because he's still in the house because the cops are useless.
Yes.
Continuing thread. And that movie also ends with our final girl tragically murdered, with everyone of authority being incapable of helping her after gaslighting her through an entire movie.
And after she just fought like hell to protect herself.
The difference being that Black Christmas somehow manages to handle that in a way that is shocking and tragic, and yet also feels like deliberate commentary, because it's set up throughout that mm-hmm. that's what this movie is interested in talking about. This one ends very similarly to Black Christmas, but it feels like it does so in an exploitative way.
Yes.
To be cruel and hurtful and sort of revel in the tragedy and pain of it. And this is the first time I think I have ever seen a video nasty, so-called, that I would genuinely put on a list like that and say, this is a reprehensible, offensive movie that has an ending that is... that is deeply wrong. And it's like, I would have no authority to say, don't make this stuff. In fact, frankly, go ahead and make it, because now we know the kind of person you are and we know to avoid your work.
And maybe that's so. Like, the best way to put it is, like, when you talk about a movie like Black Christmas, if I didn't know otherwise, I could think that Black Christmas was written and or directed by women, because it's so clear, the tone of the film and the point of view and the voices of women and the problems of women and everything in Black Christmas feels like it could have been created by women. Everything in Death Dorm, the dorm that dripped blood, pranks. Everything in that movie feels like it was written and created and directed by the worst kind of men.
Yeah.
And it just comes through clearly. Like, there's no message, there's no, like, oh, isn't this terrible, like, the things that are done to women. It's like, no, not at all. And there's no one left and no one around to point to the bad guy and say, this is bad. And, like, she doesn't even get a chance to point to him and say, this is bad, because one of the last things she does is try to flip the script on him and do the thing that many women are taught to do and just apologize and say, oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't understand how deep your feelings were. We just need to come down off this roof and, like, talk through everything. You know, I just didn't get it. And he's starting to let up. And then, of course, Townie guy shows up and then everything goes haywire again. But it's like, she has to try everything possible to get him to back off. And ultimately, it's all futile. And he's not, it's not like he's treated like a hero. I mean, he's shown to be crazy. Like, he's yeah. not painted like somebody who is a character to identify with. And he's kind of a jerk the whole movie. So it's not like he's the nice guy throughout. So it that takes it, like, one level up from the bottom for me, because it's not like they have the nice guy turn out to be the one who's like, oh, I'm so sick of being the nice guy, because where does it get me? That's the worst kind of storyline. But this one, he's just kind of a jerk, and it turns out he's a homicidal crazy jerk. Who knew? And, like, that's it. That's the story.
And while we're watching, I was thinking it fits perfectly with a lot of discourse that we have today,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting, because we watched the second, and the first one we watched definitely felt, the deeper we got into it, like a movie that you could just, with a few tweaks, release today,
mm-hmm.
and it would be equally as relevant and resonate. I think we're done with The Dorm That Dripped Blood, aren't we?
I'm forever done with The Dorm That Dripped Blood.
I really must go now.
But the first thing we watched and the second thing we're talking about, and I decided to flip it because I wanted to end on a higher note, is Christmas Evil from 1980, which is a weird thing in terms of the history of horror movies. And they keep calling it a slasher, but it is not a slasher in a traditional way.
And it's also called Better Watch Out.
It's also referred to as You Better Watch Out. Apparently, in some cases, it's turned up as Terror in Toyland, but I haven't seen any visual evidence of that.
Some fun alliteration.
But mainly, it's Christmas Evil. It's one of those weird things where a few years ago, I didn't even know this movie existed. And then all of a sudden, it was like a switch was thrown. And everywhere you looked, it was always on like, we used to look every year for, like, what are the movies for Halloween? What are the movies for Christmas that are horror movies? What are the horror Thanksgiving movies, which there used to be, like, one. Now there's, like, 12.
Remember when Hulu did that thing where they tried to release a movie a month for every holiday?
Yeah. And they still do, I think.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, a few years ago, Christmas Evil started turning up on lists, and I was like, what is this? And it's from 1980, and it's also always weird when it happens like that, where it's like, I would know about this, wouldn't I?
And it's not a foreign film. It was made in New Jersey.
And it's like, where did this come from? And then not only did it appear, but like it appeared almost, it seems, with an instant reputation as like better than average. And I'm thinking, how did it get it when none of us knew it existed? But now here it is.
Apparently it's John Waters' favorite holiday film.
Yeah, it's an interesting story about that. I looked up a little more. He was once quoted as saying it's the greatest Christmas movie ever made. He apparently did a commentary track with the creator of the movie. I think the writer-director, Lewis Jackson. And yet some people noted that during the commentary, Waters appears to be reacting to things in the movie as if he's never seen it before and is surprised by it. So it could be that he was just screwing around and decided to have fun with it and maybe didn't really know it beforehand.
I don't know. It feels like something John Waters would watch every year.
But I mean, I still think, yeah, I mean, it certainly makes sense.
Yeah.
It's definitely not there are murders, but they're few and far between. They really only happen in a couple specific spots. It's much more a deeply tragic, slow character study.
Mm-hmm.
And as one review wrote, has a self-consciously art house approach that Jackson said was influenced by Thomas Nast, Douglas Sirk, and a few other people. He was really thinking when he was putting this movie together. And it stars alongside a ton of recognizable character actors like Mark Margolis and Jeffrey DeMunn and a lot of other people. Every place you turn, I saw another character actor I recognized.
I think the youngest Jeffrey DeMunn we've ever seen.
I think so. It stars Fiona Apple's father, Brandon Maggart, who I always remember from the 80s sitcoms Brothers on Showtime and Jennifer Slept Here with Angelian. And those are the only two things I really ever remember him from.
Mm-hmm.
And also with a beard. It was really weird watching Brandon Maggart without a beard because
One eventually.
Yeah, he does kind of. It felt right when he had the beard. So Christmas Evil, he's Harry Stadling. He seems to be a very insular, lonely little guy who lives a lonely little life. He's got a brother in Jeffrey DeMunn who has a wife and kids and has the ostensibly normal life, but he's also kind of a dick.
And this one does follow the formula where it starts with the flashback to Christmas 1947.
And we get an opening where the two brothers, when they were young, witnessed a man dressed as Santa Claus having sexual contact with their mother, except it's their father. And apparently this is traumatic for him. Granted, you know, you see something like that. I don't know. Some kids, I guess, could be traumatic. But then we find out he has spent the rest of his life surrounding himself at all times with all manner of Christmas iconography and basically aspiring to be Santa Claus to the point where finally the world conspires to give him just the right breaking points where he decides he's going to quite literally become Santa Claus and not only dole out presents to the good boys and girls, but mete out a little justice to people who are making Christmas worse. But I still can't quite figure out where the trauma comes from.
It's kind of unclear, and I think you talked about some people's interpretations of it, and I think the closest we can get is that they first watched like what's supposed to be the the standard Christmas magic. Santa comes down the chimney. The classic Santa washes his hands at the hand washing station.
Yeah, and what then was that about?
Butters a piece of bread from the bread and butter station.
I thought you put cookies and milk out for Santa. They put out a hand washing station and bread and butter.
Look, that's what Dad likes.
What is this?
I don't know.
Well, we know what Dad likes.
But anyway, yeah, we do. And it's very consensually and loving his own wife, which, you know, that's yes. what Dad likes, which is, we'll get there. But anyway, so Mom's got the kids on the stairs. They see the boots come down the chimney and, you know, okay, and he puts the presents under and then goes back up. And, you know, he's a little, like, sort of focused on, oh, Christmas, like how wonderful Christmas, and his brother, his little brother, is the cynical one who's like, eh, it's just Dad, and like, how could you say that? And he like hears stuff and he goes running downstairs, and that's when he sees Santa and Mom like starting to get busy consensually and lovingly in yes. the living room. There's like nothing like graphic or like weird or violent or anything. Like some of these movies, like they'll have the flashback be like,
I mean,
you see Santa tie up Mom or something.
And I mean, it's like, I was thinking the first thing I thought of is Silent Night, Deadly Night yeah. stars with a vicious attack by someone dressed as Santa.
Right.
And it's like, okay, I get why that would scar a kid for life and should.
Yeah.
You know, in that context. But this is like, there's nothing wrong with what's going on. And granted, okay, a little kid seeing like a sex going on maybe be thrown a little bit, but yeah. it's warm and nice and like white
and why? Fully clothed,
yeah,
like there's nothing really explicit about it, but I think maybe the idea is that like ruins the magic of Christmas for him, which was something he was very fixated on and something that was very important to him, and probably why they went through the whole Santa charade, because they were very Christmas obsessed kids. And so for him, it's like he's now got to spend the rest of his life trying to figure out like how to make magic with Christmas. And if you can't trust that Santa will mark like who's good and who's bad, he has to personally take responsibility for that. And you can see he's got like historic books of good girls and bad girls and boys.
He's using binoculars and watching
for every year, everybody. Though he's got like little encyclopedias yeah. on his shelf, and he gets these books made, which maybe like the person, but I guess maybe he makes them himself. He's very crafty.
We find out throughout the movie he's one of the most capable, industrious, and creative people I've ever seen in a movie. He can do anything.
He can do anything. So he like decides that he himself is the only like arbiter of what is good and bad and like worthy of Santa's attention, and from all appearances also has a very good relationship with the neighborhood children, because he himself is still kind of childlike.
But it's weird, like it's very creepy the things he does.
Yes,
like looking through their windows, observing what they're doing, and yet not to okay any of this.
Mm-mm.
Nothing he does involving the children appears to be in any way deviant. Other than the observing and like violating their privacy, he treats them as children. He respects them as children. The kids in the neighborhood love him and talk to him all the time. He's also respected, if treated a bit like, oh, there's that Harry again, caring about people, by other people at his job, including the executives who gave him a promotion. Like, in other words, another thing, too, is a lot of that times in these stories, it'll be the story where, like, one of the breaking points is the character finds out he's fired right before Christmas. No, he's been promoted.
At the Christmas toy factory.
Yeah, and he works at a Christmas. Now, of course, one of the breaking points for him is when he sees that their work is subpar. And
right.
they're not. But he's respected.
Yeah.
So, but he is alone.
And he comes up with ideas that are good for the company, even though they don't execute them to his high standards.
Yeah, he wants them to make lead toy soldiers, and they go with plastic. And I'll tell you something, though. It's like, you know, they're dodging a bullet there by not going with his plan. But who knew back then?
Right.
But he makes them in lead. But also, but yeah. He's got like, he's good at like smelting and metallurgy, whatever.
Basically, he's got his own like toy factory in his own house, and when he goes through his list of like good girls and boys. He decides what each of them is going to get. He makes them a present. And we're not talking like Nightmare Before Christmas, like creepy vampire duck.
Nice presents.
They're nice presents. Hand-carved wooden dolls, hand-poured, yes, like, and painted lead soldiers, drums.
And he is obsessed as well with negativity. Like this one kid, Moss Garcia, who's like the kid he hates most of all, apparently, for little things like just generally dickish behavior, it looks like. It's a long list.
Yeah. I mean, there's like stuff that's just like general kid stuff, like being a jerk, but he also apparently like kicks animals and stuff.
But you do also see that his mother smacks him. So you know that he's in an abusive household. That's how these things happen. And Harry's decision is to, in true Santa Claus style, like scare him a little bit. But I think definitely with the idea of he wants to try to make Moss see the light.
Right.
Like he's not punishing. That's the other thing, is his punishment. Like there's at least one scene where he mentions something about if a kid's bad, he's going to bring horrible things to them. And you think, oh my God, it's a slasher movie. He's going to bring them like a severed head.
Nope.
He brings them a bag of dirt.
But now I want you to remember to stay good boys and girls. Respect your mothers and fathers and do what they tell you. Obey your teachers and learn a whole lot. Now, if you do this, I'll make sure you get good presents from me every year. But if you're bad boys and girls, your name goes in the bad boys and girls book, and I'll bring you something horrible.
Basically just the idea of, I just want to show you being bad doesn't get you good things.
He wants to show them that someone notices when you're bad and it means something.
And in one of the nicest parts of the movie, one of the things he chooses to do is he sees on television. Oh, that's another thing. So the whole thematic thing in this
movie. We're going all over the place because the movie is kind of unfocused itself.
He works for this company, Jolly Dream. They make toys, but they kind of make crappy toys that don't hold together very well.
And most of the people who work there don't care that they're crappy toys. It's an assembly line job. They just want to assemble the toys and not get laid off after Christmas.
Right. And one of the things he finds out through a TV ad at one point that is very much a parody of Geraldo Rivera's Willowbrook coverage, mm-hmm, which was about a state hospital.
Which we talked about when we did an episode where we watched Cropsey.
The documentary Cropsey. They do a version of that in this, where like the state hospital with these children, you know, at this hospital. And one of the things he decides to do is to bring bags and bags of toys to that hospital and distribute them to all the kids.
Because he's found out the company's not actually going to give them all the toys because they're supposed to.
The company is doing it, except they let Harry know that they're actually going to like kind of sort of strong arm the employees into donating money. They want the corporation, that's a toy corporation supposedly doing good things for children, is going to get their own employees to bankroll their charity to the state hospital while taking full credit for being an awesome company that helped all the kids at the state hospital.
Right.
It was at this point that we suddenly realized Christmas Evil was a movie for 2024 that just happened to be released in 1980, looking like a 70s movie.
And they're like really proud of this new executive who came up with the PR plan.
Yeah, that involves cheating their own employees to pay for making themselves look great.
Yeah.
And so Harry's idea is, I'm going to take toys to every kid in that hospital. And although he initially encounters a little bit of security, everybody at the hospital embraces him as a true Santa Claus. One of them even like kisses him and hugs him. And with them, again, he's fine. He doesn't do anything terrible. He wants to give the kids toys. He wants to be Santa Claus. And he gets full validation as a real Santa in that scene. In a normal Christmas movie, that would have been a scene of like triumph.
But in a normal Christmas movie, before he did that, he would not have permanently glued the beard to his face and pulled on it for a couple of minutes on camera to make sure it was never coming off, because he knew tonight he was going to die in that beard.
And also, like, giggling and laughing and saying, it's me, over
yeah,
and over.
Yeah, I that mean, scene, really trying way, to, like, embrace that he is Santa now.
It was around that point where you said that this would be an A24 movie today.
Yeah.
Although I like this, so and maybe he, not so much.
He gets his reinforcement, too, because when he drops off all the presents at the children's hospital, he literally has not done anything bad yet, except break into people's houses.
Yes.
But he breaks into their houses to leave better presents under the trees than the ones they have for their own children.
The only house we see him go into prior to that is his brother's house.
Yeah.
So not even strangers yet. But yeah, assume something would happen. But he goes to his brother's
house.
Yeah,
so he's like leaving good presents instead of bad ones. And then he goes to the children's hospital. And when the security guard, he gives the security guard one present, says, here, take this inside, basically say, like, open it, you can see, like, I'm not bringing you anything but joy for the kids, you know. And he goes inside, and while he's inside, he's practicing his, like, ho 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 Merry Christmas until he really finds his voice.
Yes.
And as he's doing that, standing outside, really suddenly, like, getting that timbre in his voice,
yeah,
that says to him, I'm Santa, it starts snowing. And it's like, if any other movie did this, it'd be like the ray of light from the heavens that tells him, I'm doing the right thing. I am Santa.
And perhaps it is. And we'll get back to that.
Maybe. I mean, it might be.
I want to get back to a couple things. One of which is that it's the mirror scene where I suddenly realized Brandon Maggart should have been nominated for an Oscar that year.
Absolutely.
And I genuinely mean it. His performance in this from start to finish is amazing. It's very subtle.
He does so much of his acting alone.
He carries most of the movie alone and with very little dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
He really starts talking more as Santa than he certainly doesn't talk much as Harry at all. But he's amazing to watch. And yeah, and I do mean it because, yeah, you see some of the people that get nominated for Oscars and what they did. Brandon Maggart should have been nominated for an Oscar. Okay, I don't know. I'd have to look up who else was up that year. Maybe he wouldn't have won, but he should have gotten the nomination. And the other thing, too, is that he goes to that party. He gets kind of pulled into a party. An adult, not adult, but a party with adults there. Not a kid's party. Oh, they do have their children
there.
Yeah,
they have their children there.
Yeah, they do have their kids there.
It seems like it's the kind of place that's like a local,
club
that's like built around like some sort of specific tradition. Like, you know, some people are involved in like Irish dance clubs or like the Polish community. Like, so they were doing some kind of rhythmic dancing.
Yeah, they do have their kids there too. So they have families and they see him outside walking by and they, oh, it's a Santa Claus. And they bring him in and he totally goes into it. And that's the scene where he does a whole speech about, you know, when he's leaving about be good boys and girls and I'll bring you something. But then he said, but if you're bad, I'll bring you something horrible. And you pointed out it was specifically the women in the room, a couple of the mothers who suddenly react like, oh, wait a minute. This was a stranger we just pulled in from outside, right? This isn't sounding, except still, even at that point, it sounds creepy. But then he starts laughing. And also, Santa Claus says that stuff in other things. I hear that in Christmas stuff all the time.
Santa Claus and other things didn't show up at that party after brutally murdering a couple of people outside the church.
Oh, yeah, I skipped that part.
Yeah.
So he does stop at the church at midnight mass where the executives from the Jolly Dream toy company that he works at are
on the way back from the children's hospital.
And he proceeds to stab one of them in the eye with a soldier and kill, ultimately three or four of them
with a
like
hatchet?
Immediately and just kill them right on the steps of the church. But, you know.
While the executives he was like seething at the party watch from the top of the stairs. And it's unclear, like, did he go there with the intent to like harm them? Or is it sort of like leaving the bag of dirt for Moss Garcia where he went there to show them what happens, like, to jerks? I don't know. Or he didn't have a plan at all. I don't know.
Because the weird thing is the main executive and that new guy that brought in the state hospital program don't get killed.
No.
And I thought they were definitely going to get killed.
Mm-mm. No, but the people that he does attack outside that church are definitely jerks.
Oh, absolutely.
And you can even hear when they're interviewing some of the people in the crowd, even say it, like that they were jerks.
He also then specifically goes after one coworker at home who was a real rat to him and literally kills him in bed right next to the wife, who then wakes up to his corpse. And I love the fact that the button on that later is with the police there and everything. Her one reaction to her husband's brutal murder in her bed is, how am I supposed to pay for everything now? And it's like clear that, like, okay, so nobody cares that he's dead. It's just that money.
He doesn't just kill the guy. He tries to smother him with a bag of toys. And when that's not going fast enough, he ends up grabbing a tree topper off a Christmas tree that's for some reason in the bedroom and kills him with it.
Cops start picking up on it, at which point you thought, here's where the thread starts, where the cops are going to start following him through the rest of the night. Only for us to find out that after like one or two scenes, the cops never turn up again, have no role in the story, and everybody are useless. Absolutely.
What we also learned is that there's some neighborhood in New Jersey where people are fully ready at any time with torches as if they live in a Bavarian village in the 1800s and are used to chasing Frankenstein through the streets.
Yes. I don't know how that happens.
Like, not just like one or two. There's like a whole horde of people with torches because they like realize who he is. It's been all over the news now and a description, and he just gets enamored by an amazing Christmas lawn display, and kids find him, and he's nice to them and gives them presents.
Oh, and I love that the kids protect him.
Yes.
The kids turn on their own parents, and one little girl actually grabs a knife that the father was going to use against Harry's Santa, and she picks it up and brings it over to Harry. It's just beautiful.
And one of the kids actually puts his body between the knife guy and Santa.
Yeah.
I mean, like, clearly,
yeah,
if you go off of this, like, impression that the children can see the goodness.
Yes. And not only that, we're firmly in the Christmas mold. And even if you don't believe that the rest of the year, one of the standard things of terms of the multitude of Christmas themes that we have to deal with every year,
yeah,
is that children can see the good in people. Children can see the magic. Children understand. Well, if that's the case, Harry's the good one.
I just had a realization, and I don't know if it's what the filmmaker was going for, but like, good lordy, is it Christmassy? Which is, one, maybe Harry really does become Santa when he does this, where we can get to that, but also he's kind of Jesus, where like, the children love him. He gets into his last confrontation is with his own brother, who strangles him seemingly to death.
Yeah, his brother is a real murderous psychopath.
And puts him in the car, and we think he's dead. And then suddenly he's not. He is somehow resurrected through the magic of Christmas.
Oh, that's right.
And then gets chased by the mob before he like drives his van over the edge of a cliff and like ostensibly ascends to heaven.
Yeah, we literally watched the van fly into the full moon that he was like mesmerized by earlier in the night. And although I said at the time, you could definitely read that ending as it's what's in his head as he's plummeting to his death and he's dying.
Because he's painted the sleigh on the van and pretending he has reindeer the whole night.
But there is a quick cutaway shot of his brother looking up as if watching him while we're seeing the van fly away, as if to say it is flying away, which is what I was referring to earlier. And I thought, I don't think it's intended to be real, but if you want to, you could read this as he genuinely has become Santa at the end.
He's like Santa and also kind of Jesus.
Resurrected.
Like resurrected and then called home.
Yeah. I didn't think about that.
I thought about it literally just this minute, like realizing that there's nothing in this movie that makes you want to dislike this character. Like, there have been other films where you have like that main character who goes a little wacky.
I mean, it's crazy that he's spying on all the neighborhood children. That shouldn't be happening.
It shouldn't be happening. And
but he also doesn't do anything to them.
Once it's like it was creepy because it was right towards the start of the movie. And then as soon as you get a little further into the film, you realize that he's so childlike himself and that he's almost more like a Willy Wonka style character.
He is very much
than
like
a neighborhood creeper.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And so it became kind of clearer over time that there is something like wholesome and good about this character who is so angry and frustrated at all the people around him who refuse to do even the bare minimum of goodness. Like, and that is as small as like just make a decent toy or care about your job on this assembly line.
Another very 2024 theme.
Yeah, up to the executives who have absolute ability and power to do good things for people, to like give people bonuses and to give toys mm-hmm. away to children. And the people who he treats well are the ones who see him on the street and like welcome him in and give him a drink and dance with him and celebrate Santa. And it's like the bare minimum. Like if somebody, granted, not the best idea to just pull some strange man into your party. But I mean, it's not like in a home. It was in like a neighborhood, like Kiwanis Club style place. And they could have like chased him away with a stick or whatever. And instead they were like, hey, Santa's here. Come on in. And like the first thing they do is like, this will warm you up. It's like, even if he's just some weirdo who likes to dress as Santa, they're like, yeah, give him a drink. Like, give him a snack. It's Christmas time. And it's like, it's the bare minimum that you can do is just show care for another person.
Little empathy
goes a long way. And like, that's literally his message. Like some of like the good boys and girls, literally all the good that they do is just sitting alone at home in their room, being like caring and empathetic to a dolly.
Yeah.
And he's right. Like, oh, what a good little girl. Like what a little angel. Yeah. Because all she's doing is pretending to care about a fake thing.
And meanwhile, in extended and deleted scenes, we took a look at one thing you find out that you don't find out in the cut that we saw the movie. Is that his brother works as a city marshal, and he talks something about, he's already got a family in there that's like in tears.
He's like repossesses
right at Christmas
things.
Time. He makes money off things, he says. And it's like, he's garbage mm-hmm. and a murderer.
And he comes out of it okay.
And he, yeah, as far as we know. Yeah, I mean.
And also his wife and children love seeing Uncle Harry every year. And they were like sad that he wasn't going to come.
Yeah.
So the kids love him.
Yeah.
And the wife thinks he's just a sweet man that her husband's too mean to.
Couple little side notes, by the way, just random things. Mm. As if for some reason at the little club party, there's a band playing. And at one point I saw a guy playing the accordion and I thought, boy, he looks familiar. And I looked it up and it was Danny Federici, one of the founding members of the East Street Band.
They did film in New Jersey.
Yes, so I guess. And the thing is, 1980. So one thing I said to Natalie was, okay, so this is after Born to Run. This is like, but I guess
just doing a favor for some people. And at that same party, one of the guys who brings Santa in to the party, I mean, he came up on screen and I was like, hey, he's in Lady Mobster, which is a movie that we watch all the time on Riff Tracks.
I think I mentioned is Mark Margolis, who's a longtime character actor. I remember him very well from a Rashomon style Next Generation where Riker is accused of murdering that guy's wife or him. But I
know him from Lady Mobster.
Lady Mobster. Most people today will know him as, I think it's Hector Salamanca in Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. And he's got a very small part in this. But there are a lot of the guy whose name totally escapes me, but who plays William Hurt's father in Broadcast News is in this.
Every actor from New Jersey is in
this.
And some musicians.
Yeah, apparently. Bruce might be in there for all we know. But
you even made a joke while we were watching because he's like pulled over and looking at the New York skyline, filling a bag of dirt for Mos Garcia. And you made a joke where you were like New York views at New Jersey prices.
Yeah, it's like the same place that the Italian filmmakers always go to shoot and they want the skyline in the background, but don't want to go into Manhattan. And they'll like shoot in that little spot like where Escape the Bronx one.
Yeah, Escape 2000.
Yeah, they all shoot in that spot so they can look over the river and not have to, yeah.
I guess the real issue here is that you want to be on Team Harry. And we've said we kind of feel like we're on Team Harry for most of the movie, if not all of the movie. Because it feels like he's sort of a vigilante in his own way. but it also still feels random and chaotic and violent, and arguably, you know, murder not being the appropriate answer to, like, being a jerk on the street. Like, the people who were taunting him outside the church were just kind of, like, being, like, jerky bros. And then he was like, well, I guess I gotta stab you through the eye with a toy soldier. And, like, it's sort of, it's a conflicted feeling, because you're like, he is representing goodness and they're representing evil. And I think maybe it's to the credit of the movie that it, like, puts you on the side of arguably the slasher in your slasher movie.
I think another thing that was interesting was I felt almost from the beginning that it had Twilight Zone kind of vibes to it. It was reminding me of aspects of other movies. The torch-bearing crowd felt like Monsters Are Due on Maple Street kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But the one that I kept thinking of was the Art Carney Santa Claus episode, Night of the Meek. Of course, the thing that I now think of that I wasn't thinking of in terms of the connection when I thought of that episode while watching it is that that episode is, in fact, about a guy who literally becomes Santa Claus by the end.
Much like the film The Santa Claus.
Yeah. But the less said about that guy, the better.
I know.
But
it turns out they were stealing from Christmas Evil when they made that movie.
But that's it. Like, you know, is this a version of Night of the Meek, but a darker one? And is Harry really becoming Santa Claus at the end? Maybe it's not a fantasy at the end of the movie.
In a sense, maybe Santa does have, like, a little Krampus in him. And if you see it that way, then maybe it works.
Thanks for listening to Ghouls in the House, featuring Natalie B. Latofsky and Arnold T. Blumberg. You can find Natalie on Threads at Positively Natalie and me at Doctor of the Dead. Our movies this episode were The Dorm That Dripped Blood, 1982, and Christmas Evil, 1980.
Santa Claus!
Ghouls in the House is an ATB Publishing production. Check out our other podcasts, books on your favorite fictional worlds, and other assorted goodies at www.atbpublishing.com.